This is the Airplane Geeks Podcast. Our aim is to educate and inform you, explore and expand your passion for aviation, and entertain you a little along the way. This episode, our pod Zakel answers the question, is gender still holding women back in the aviation industry? In the news, pilots might be required to take sim training before flying the 737 MAX. Coronavirus concerns hit air travel hard and impact profitability. Regional carriers continue to struggle. A pilot is arrested and jailed in Turkey. And a good story about American Airlines. All that and more coming up right now. Welcome to the Airplane Geeks Podcast. This is episode 593 of the show where we talk aviation. I'm Max Flight. And joining me first is our aviation historian, David Vanderhoof.
Hey, folks. How is everybody? All's clear here in Pennsylvania. We haven't had our coronavirus strike yet, but I'm sure it's coming. So we seems to be a conversation that everybody's having everywhere these days.
That's right. I think, just wait, David. I think you'll experience it soon enough, unfortunately.
Unlike you two, where you're in states where it's already happened.
Well, Max Trescott is with us. He's host of Aviation News Talk podcast. He's a CFI of the year. And, of course, he's an expert on the Cirrus aircraft. Hey, Max.
Hey, hello, everyone. I just wanted to take a chance to say my goodbyes here if necessary. As we mentioned before the show, most of the California coronavirus cases are right here in Santa Clara County. And as I heard just a day or two ago, one of the most recent cases being treated at the hospital half mile down the street here. So it's like, oh man, you hate hearing that. And of course, we have a number of stories in the news today related to that, because it's certainly having an impact on the aviation world.
Yeah, it sure is. It sure is. All right. Well, our guest this episode is Arpad Zakel. He's an aviation and aerospace lead at Cellence Plus. Now, that's an executive search and assessment firm. They specialize in aviation and aerospace. Arpad is an aviation attorney by background, but he's also a hobby glider pilot. Now, he researched and authored an article for the Royal Aeronautical Society titled, Is Gender Still Holding Women Back in the Aviation Industry? It's really an excellent piece. We wanted to benefit from what Arpad has learned, but we've been stymied by time zone differences. And so instead of being with us right now live here, I recorded a conversation with Arpad last week, and we'll play that in a little bit. But first, we've got some aviation news from the last week. Is everyone ready?
Ready from the east.
Ready from the west.
Our first article comes from Bloomberg. FAA tells Boeing more training for 737 MAX pilots may be needed. Well, Boeing originally said pilots wouldn't need simulator training for the 737 MAX, but their position has changed. And Max T, I guess this is resulting from some flight simulation tests that were conducted with pilots back in December.
Yes. So I think most people who follow the story probably know that when the 737 MAX was first released, separate training was not required for that aircraft, because Boeing said that essentially it's close enough to the existing 737s. And of course, they didn't make declarations in the pilot operating handbooks about the system that does some automatic controls of the, what is that, the MCAS. That's right. The MCAS system does some automatic controls of the elevator. Well, so now the final shoe has dropped, and it's definitely the case that Boeing will have to do separate training, and it sounds like there might have to be some separate simulators created and things like that. So, yeah, this is a major push-up, a lot of work that's going to have to occur both with Boeing, with the airlines, with pilots are going to have to train. And I did see a separate article that said one of the things that makes getting recertification of the aircraft a little bit more difficult is that the people responsible on both sides are – some of the same people who were in the news because of text messages that said, hey, I may have unintentionally lied to Boeing, to FAA. And also, I think there was a fairly negative comment about an FAA person. It said after a presentation that was something like having dogs watch television or something like that. And so that was pretty, that was pretty insulting. So yeah, we've talked about this before. People, don't send text messages and emails within your company that say these kinds of things, because it always comes out in the end.
It does. It sure does. Well, in these sim tests in December, what they were trying to do is examine or observe how pilots responded to the new MCAS software upgrades after they had received some training. And they had pilots there from the three U.S. airlines flying the 737 MAX, that, of course, being American Airlines, United Airlines, and Southwest. But they were also joined by some pilots from Aeromexico. And they were presented with a number of different emergency scenarios. And I think the result was not as catastrophic as the two fatal crashes, but still things were not perfect. In some cases, the pilots failed to finish an emergency MCAS checklist. There was some difficulty, it's reported, with some of the emergency procedures related to certain sensor failures. And then some pilots got a little confused about how the autopilot behaved in some circumstances. And they also found that their interactions with some of the plane's automated warning systems were distracting. I think too many sirens and such at too loud a level. So with all that, I think the FAA kind of has – well, there's nothing they can do except, I think, require some simulator training for the new MAX control software.
Yep. In fact, I saw that folks like United, for example, have just postponed one of their investor talks that they were going to have because things are kind of up in the air, both with Corona and I guess to some extent with 737 MAX.
Yeah. And, speaking of that, there's an article in CNBC. Amazon tells employees to pause non-essential travel in U.S. due to coronavirus. And Amazon sent a notice to their employees asking them to defer non-essential employee travel within the United States. Amazon says they'll reassess that at the end of April. But previously in January, Amazon said it was restricting employee to China until further notice. And I mean, this is something that we're seeing with greater frequency, with events being canceled, travel being restricted. And of course, this has a big impact on commercial aviation.
And the story on Amazon was one of the first ones to come out, but there have been a number of companies since then that have announced. For example, Twitter has banned non-critical business travel due to coronavirus. That was announced on Sunday, and a Google employee tested positive for the coronavirus in Europe. I don't know if they're limiting travel.
They canceled a major investor meeting to avoid travel, international travel.
And there are a number of pharma companies that have announced that they are limiting travel. I'm not familiar with these, but they include AbbVie, GSK, and Sanofi, all limiting employee travel.
Hmm. I wonder if that's not only just employee travel, but the fact that a lot of I know GlaxoSmithKline or GSK is one of the lead institutions for the coronavirus, the antivirus and the test kit. So that might be an all hands on deck problem more than just the travel. But as of today here in the United States, we've got. And it's not just the China and Asia. I mean, we're now canceling flights to Northern Italy and Italy, and everybody as of today, which is the 2nd of March, all flights from Korea and all flights from Italy are coming to the United States, with people being pre-screened before they get on the plane, screened on the plane, and then when they land at their whatever their destination airport.
And many companies have also canceled conferences, and I think that's going to have a big impact. So we're hearing about cancellations in Florida, Las Vegas, places where people are holding major conventions and conferences. And that's going to be a major hit to restaurants, hotels, I think, as well as to the airlines. Here's another story that says Ericsson, LG, and other tech companies discouraging travel to China.
It's kind of harks back to the issue in 2008. When, in order to save money, most of these major companies started going to video conferencing, and there was a huge, and that didn't help the travel industry at all because these people weren't going to conferences. We sort of gotten away from that and had gotten back to face to face, and here we are back again later on, and we're in an environment where we're going to go back to digital conferencing and people staying siloed and not interacting with each other.
Yeah, I did see a story that Zoom is seeing far more minutes being used and far more people on their teleconferences right now.
Great, Derek. Well, thank God we don't need Skype anymore.
Well, sometimes we do, but not as often. But of course, with all of these events being canceled, with people reluctant to travel on vacations and things like that, of course, the demand for airline flights is dropping, and United is impacted by this pretty heavily. United has a lot of trans-Pacific flights, and those are the ones where we're seeing some significant decreases in the demand for seats. United has cut flights. China's service is, CNBC puts it, collapsed entirely. And in fact, the rest of their Trans-Pacific routes are down 75%. So United is offering pilots a month off at reduced pay, which is, one way to respond to the decreased demand for pilots.
Yes. So I also saw a story from American Airlines, and they're doing exactly the same thing now. They, too, have come out and said, hey, we need to have pilots take some voluntary time off, and we'll pay you a little bit less than what you'd normally get. And this story on United says that for the pilots flying the wide bodies across the Pacific, they'd roughly work about 80 hours a month, and they're offering to pay them for 50 hours a month if they'll take off the month of April. So yeah, if the virus continues to spread, then we're going to see all kinds of impacts to scheduling and to employment of people that are in these industries.
And Max, I'm going to ask you a question. What does that do when we go to an environment like this? What do the pilots do? So they get a whole month off. That's a whole month without flying. What do they do for skills keep up? Is that part of the reduced thing? Is they're expected to go fly a simulator for some hours? How do they handle that?
It's a good question. I don't know what they would do in the airlines. I would say that 1 month is probably not enough to see a large degradation in the skills. So I wouldn't imagine that they're going to have to do special training. Now, if they were off 60 days or for sure 90 days, I can't imagine them bringing someone back after 90 days without having done some work again in the simulator.
Hmm. Well, I guess the medium to longer term impact is going to depend on what the duration of this virus event is. How long does it last? And does it precipitate some general, I don't want to use the word recession, but some
economic downturn?
Economic
downturn. Would you prefer that?
Yeah, that sounds nicer and less alarmist. we'll go with that. But because these things ripple through an economy, and there could, just as a to make a point, there could be a vaccine tomorrow. But that doesn't mean the switch is instantly thrown and everybody recovers economically from this right away. So, if we get some significant duration to this, it might, precipitate this kind of downturn.
Well, I think the most amazing thing to come out of this was, I don't know if you guys saw this, but CNN had two photos that NASA took of China. And because of the virus in China and everybody and the work slowdowns and stuff, the atmosphere over China has cleared because production's down so low.
Wow.
So the smog and the and we'll have this link in the show notes. This downturn, I mean, literally you can see the air has cleaned itself up because there's so little productivity in China.
Interesting.
Would make sense. If production is down, you're not going to need as much electricity. You take some of those coal-fired electric plants offline. Remember when I visited China about 10 years ago, I was standing on the Great Wall watching traffic go by beneath me, and I was watching for about 5 minutes when suddenly it hit me. I was seeing an empty coal truck pass under the wall there about once every 60 seconds. And it was amazing to realize that and then continue watching. And it continued. So they use a tremendous amount of coal in the Beijing area for their power plants.
Yeah, they do. I remember, when I was traveling there to visit Air China and some of the government agencies, I guess you'd call them, that control commercial aviation in China. In Beijing at that time, you would see horse-drawn carts, believe it or not, carrying coal, navigating through the streets in Beijing. So I don't think there's as many horses as there were 15 years ago in Beijing, but still a lot of coal burned.
I don't remember seeing any when I was there 10 years ago.
Yeah, that was kind of an eye-opener.
But how about some good news coming from the coronavirus, if that's even possible?
Well, there is one segment out there that is benefiting from it. It's not really a big surprise, and that's the bizjet operators. This comes from avweb.com. Bizjet operators see COVID-19 bump, and it reports that, not surprisingly, interest in business aircraft and charter has gone up in the last few weeks. And one of the things I thought was kind of interesting is not only is the business up, but they're packing the aircraft more. In the past, when people are chartering, they wouldn't mind having, just one or two people on the board. And now they're essentially filling them up. So it sounds to me like companies are probably putting people on charters who don't normally fly a charter, and they're just packing up those airplanes and getting costs that are not that much higher than flying on the airlines.
Yeah, I guess that you can kind of expect that. People are going to try to travel without spending their journey with large crowds if they can afford to do that.
We were talking just briefly before the show about whether this would impact large shows like Sun and Fun in Florida or EAA Air Venture. And as you mentioned, a lot of those shows are outside open air. And as I mentioned, some of us have to travel inside these closed airliners to get there. So that's actually a little bit of a disincentive to fly across the country to these large events. Even if you don't think you're likely to pick something up at the event, you might pick it up during travel.
Yeah.
Which is why our head producer, head co-host, being pre-sentient and omniscient, bought a trailer to attach to his SUV, so he doesn't have to fly in these tubular things, and he can be in his own self-containment.
Max Flight likes talking about flying, not actually doing it, I think.
Yes, yeah. Otherwise, I'm going terrestrial for now. All right, we have from The Points Guy, United Airlines affiliate Trans States Airlines to cease flying. Now, Trans States Airlines, they're a regional airline. They operate feeder flights for United Airlines under the United Express brand, and they're expected to stop flying by the end of 2020.
Yeah, it's kind of interesting. I guess this is just further consolidation in the airline industry, something that we've seen with the majors and to some extent with the regional air carriers. At a time when air traffic has literally been booming, at least up until the last few weeks here, it's just kind of unusual to see them go out of business. Now, they are one of the smaller ones, and it says that there won't be any short-term impact. The jets that they have are going to be transferred to ExpressJet Airlines, so those feeder flights will continue, though, with a different company.
Right. The Embraer ERJ-145s that TransStates flies, 36 of them will be going to ExpressJet by the end of this year, beginning of next year, 2021. But they gave a couple of reasons for this. One is the industry-wide pilot shortage has made hiring difficult for the regionals, and we've seen that with some others. Republic Airways cited those kinds of hiring problems when they filed for Chapter 11 bankruptcy in 2016. And Great Lakes Aviation, similar. They shut down in 2018. So you have that going on. But also at the same time, the main lines are starting to streamline their regional providers. United is streamlining. Others are in the process of also consolidating. Delta Airlines said it's going to end its relationships with Compass Airlines and GoJet Airlines in July. So, you know, we're seeing this desire on the part of the main line. So it's tough for the regionals. I don't know what the future holds for that. It's always kind of a strange relationship, at least from my perspective, between the main lines and the regionals, what with the scope clauses and, you know, all those kind of complications. So I don't know where this will end up.
Wow, there's a phrase we haven't heard in decades.
What's that?
Scope clause.
Oh, yes, yes.
One of Dan's favorite phrases.
That's right, that's right. Yeah. Yeah, it's, you know, there are labor agreements with pilots that draw a line between the regionals and the main line. So the regionals can only fly up to a certain size, certain number of seats. Otherwise, you run afoul of this scope clause. And I think the motivation for that, for those that might be new to this concept, is that if a regional airline is typically going to pay their pilots a lot less than the mainline airlines, and if a regional starts to fly airplanes that are big enough so that they essentially compete with the mainline airlines, then you have pilots flying the same size airplane, but one class of them being paid much lower than the other, and that causes that labor problem.
And don't you think that will continue to keep the main line separate from the regionals long term, just so they can continue to have a disparity in what they pay the pilots of the smaller jets?
Yeah, that's been the case, you know, in the past for sure. I find myself wondering if that arrangement makes sense long term. I don't know. I don't know if the main lines are interested in ultimately absorbing the regionals. If the salary disparity shrinks so much because of the demand for pilots that it makes that scope clause arrangement, you know, no longer meaningful. I don't know. The world might change, but it's been a pretty strong force in the past, that's for sure.
Well, and the interesting thing is that those regionals account for about 50% of all the takeoffs and landings of airliners here in the United States. So I can imagine the main lines would be happy to not have to suddenly, you know, expand their operations that much. I mean, think about having to integrate all those operations into your company. That would be a major push-up.
Yeah, it would represent a challenge. All right, we have an article from, what is this, Hurriyet News? HurriyetDailyNews.com? I hadn't noticed that. I clicked the link before, but I hadn't really noticed what it was to. Pilot of Pegasus airplane that skidded off Istanbul airport runway arrested. Wow. So this was the Pegasus Airlines 737 that skidded off a runway at Istanbul's international airport. That was in February, and three people were killed, 179 injured. Well, the pilot's been arrested. He's been taken to prison, and he's been charged with, quote, causing death and injury by negligence. Yikes. We don't even have a completed accident investigation yet either.
And that's what really struck me about this story. It's very rare that you see stories about pilots being arrested as a result of accidents. In general, in most of the world, accidents are, you know, considered as, you know, unfortunate things that occur, but not the result of, you know, malicious or negligent effort, you know, by the pilots. But there are a few places around the world where sometimes pilots do get arrested when things go badly. In this particular case, the two aircraft prior to their approach to landing had gone around. It appears that perhaps the runway had a lot of water on it, and that maybe this aircraft had suffered from hydroplaning, which caused it to have difficulty braking. Hydroplaning for aircraft is very similar to hydroplaning for cars on a highway. And once you get that kind of layer of water between the wheels and the runway, or the wheels and the road, you have very poor braking action, and the vehicle just keeps going and going and going. They did go off the end of the runway, and the airplane, you can see from the picture here, is just, you know, it's broken off in the fuselage at two different places. So a major accident. And part of the problem was that the end of the runway here has a small drop off. It's probably, at least 30, 40, 50 feet. So when the aircraft went off the runway, it dropped down substantially. So it'll be interesting to see what happens. I'm just kind of hoping this doesn't become a trend around the world. I would hate to see accidents criminalized.
Yes. And that's diametrically opposed to the different kind of a safety culture where you don't look to assign blame, at least not criminal blame, to individuals, because as Launchpad has said, you'll clam up, you'll lawyer up and clam up if you are personally criminally liable for anything. But also, you'd much rather have a open and complete investigation where everyone participates and cooperates, so you can get at the real causes behind the accident. In this case, the pilot may be completely blameless. We don't know at this point. But Pegasus does have a history of sliding 737s, right? They had just this year, January 7th, there was another plane that skidded off the runway. This was at the same airport. There weren't any injuries.
So are you sure it's the airline or is it the airport?
Good question. Because in 2018, in January 2018, there was another Pegasus 737 that slid off a runway. This was at a different airport, but also in that one, thankfully, no one was injured. So there's three Pegasus 737s sliding off runways. Are they somehow related? Is there some kind of training issue or some kind of operating issue that is common across these? I don't know, but it sure makes you wonder.
The answer is don't fly to Turkey in January on Pegasus Air.
Yeah. So, I don't really know what the situation there is in Turkey for this pilot. But we've seen in Brazil where some pilots were arrested years ago. But I don't know what the what the likelihood is that this will end well for the pilot. I guess we'll have to let that unfold.
Well, how about some good news? Because this has been a very depressing show.
It has, hasn't it? So this is basically another positive airline story of the week. This comes from the Point Sky also. This is a priceless gift, how American Airlines employees bought one traveler extra time with her dying father. This is another good story.
Yes, this was written by a Catherine fan who I just exchanged email with here a little bit ago. And she wrote that one of their readers at thepointsky.com had sent a story about how American Airlines had gone out of their way to help her, give her, as they wrote, a priceless extra day with her dying father. She said that her father had been in hospice care for 4 months, but that his rapid decline occurred during a business trip that she was on, and she received an emergency call that she ought to get there quickly. So she booked a flight on American from Washington to Colorado Springs, connecting in Dallas-Fort Worth. However, her original outbound flight was nearly an hour late, so she was fairly sure she was going to miss the connection to the second flight to Colorado Springs. And she did what I think everyone should do if they're in this kind of situation. She passed a note to the flight attendant explaining the situation for help. And they went into action, and they later wrote back, gave her a note, and they published the the note here that said, Miss Thomas, we should be at the gate by 9:50. Our captain has let dispatch know about your situation. Ground crew at DFW is arranging for a cart to take you to your gate A23. And so sure enough, when they arrived, they had a vehicle waiting right there on the tarmac next to the aircraft and spirited her over a couple terminals away to her outbound flight. And that she did make it in time and was able to spend that extra last, few hours with her father. So great story. And, kudos to both American Airlines and, of course, to the points guy for sharing the story.
Yeah, it's always nice when you hear somebody taking some action to do the right thing for someone who really needs it. And in this case, that's exactly what happened.
And good for the passenger for saying something.
Well, that's a good point, David.
I mean, it was a very tough circumstances, but she gave the airline the ability to solve the problem, and work with dispatch and work with the other airplane and work with DFW to get the cart ready. Having traveled with my mother, who was wheelchair bound, I mean, it was important to have that stuff lined up and don't hesitate to ask a flight attendant for help. That's their primary job. Their job really isn't to serve soda. It's to protect your life and to help you in a crisis. So, I mean, I think it was really good for American Airlines, but it also was good that, the passenger gave them the ability to help them. It would be a completely different story if the passenger did that and American Airlines didn't do anything. But the fact that the passenger made the effort to do something and the flight attendants knew what to do and sent it through the chain and it worked the way it's supposed to, we really shouldn't sort of congratulate that, but it's a really good story.
Well, I think some people are reluctant to ask for help. That's something that I learned partway through my career. I had drift difficulty asking for help in the early days. And wow, it's kind of magical. You ask for help and people are just, almost want to, help you out when you ask. So it's a powerful thing. So glad she did it. And of course, it does point out that airlines are not just large, unfeeling transportation companies, but they do have people who are trying to, help people any way they can.
As I mentioned at the top of the show, our guest is Arpad Saikal, and he's somewhere over there in Europe, which is in a different time zone. And instead of speaking with us in the middle of the night, I spoke with him last week, and we recorded a conversation. And we tried to use the same technology that we're actually using right now for the audio, but it turned out that Arpad's corporate firewall prevented that. So the only way we could have our conversation was for him to be on his phone. So it's not quite the level of audio quality we hope to bring you, but he's got a good message and he learned a lot of interesting things in researching this article. So why don't we listen to my conversation with Arpad Saikal. Joining us is Arpad Saikal. He's aviation and aerospace lead with Cellience Plus in London. Now, Cellience Plus is a private executive search and selection firm. They help organizations find the best people for senior management appointments in the UK, in Australia, and internationally. Now, Arpad holds a Master of Laws in Air and Space Law from Leiden University. Arpad, welcome to the Airplane Geeks podcast.
Max, thank you for the opportunity to be here.
Leiden, is that the correct pronunciation, Leiden University?
Exactly. There are only two places in the world where you can do aviation and aerospace law. It's either Leiden in the Netherlands or in McGill in Montreal, Canada.
Ah, very good. Now, Arpad, last December, you authored a brilliant article for the Royal Aeronautical Society. It's titled, Is Gender Still Holding Women Back in the Aviation Industry? Now, what did you find about the current state of gender diversity in aviation and aerospace?
It's in a dire state, Max, because it's such a male-dominated industry, especially the C-level roles. within airlines, airports, and other parts of the industry, it's really hard to find females. In fact, when it comes to airline leadership, it's only about 3% that are actually females who are leading organizations within aviation. Not great. Really depends on the geography as well. When it comes to Asia, the airlines, airports tend to underperform there across various diversity categories. It's obviously gender is probably the only one which is measurable with data. All other things like nationality, international experience, age, those are issues that we can't really track as closely as we can gender. So that's why we tend to talk about gender most often, because it's measurable.
And I think that makes sense, that the data is just not available on other classes of individuals. Gender is relatively straightforward. But yeah, those other factors are kind of an unknown, I would think. And I also think it makes a certain amount of sense that some of this is regional. We have different cultures in different regions where women and minority groups have made different levels of progress in terms of being integrated into the professions.
Yeah, that's true. And I would even go as far as the different parts of the industry have different success when it comes to achieving gender balance. For example, low-cost airlines, definitely here in Europe, they tend to fare better when it comes to diversity. Organizations like EasyJet, Ryanair here in Europe, in the U.S., for example, JetBlue is doing a much better job than some of the more established legacy carriers when it comes to having females in their leadership roles. Some people say that basically there's a pipeline issue. Some organizations say that there are not enough females who executive search firms can choose from. Well, that's not really our experience. There are enough talented females in the industry. You just need to look hard, and that's when really search firms can help and really guide organizations, challenge them. It's an industry, maybe you will agree with me, having been in it for such a long time, it tends to look inwards when it comes to talent, tends to look at operational, technical roles for the leadership or next generation of leaders. And you don't really need that necessarily, especially when you're talking about the CEO role, which is about leading the organization, bringing people with you rather than providing technical expertise.
Yes, yes. That's interesting because, I think that particularly for the, I'll say middle management kinds of roles, many aviation aerospace companies try to develop that level organically from inside rather than hire from outside. So yeah, if there aren't a nice supply of women in that pipeline, in that internal pipeline, that it's kind of an issue for that middle level. But one of the interesting things that you have in your article is this notion that even women who outperform their male counterparts in school, that they often find that initial advantage disappears once they enter their career.
Exactly. And that's mainly because women tend to be less aggressive when it comes to negotiating for themselves. When it comes to really standing up for their organization or negotiating a business contract or a supplier agreement, they tend to do very well. But when it comes to really proactively managing their career and really standing up for themselves and building an internal network, an external network, a board of directors career-wise, resources who can help them along the way, I think men tend to perform better when it comes to positioning themselves and landing more senior roles. I think that's when they tend to lose the advantage that they have, especially at the very beginning.
Are there some things that this industry can learn from other industries when it comes to getting diversity and inclusion where it needs to be?
Definitely. I mean, certainly when it comes to hiring, certainly when it comes to developing people within the organization, I think what others in other sectors tend to do better is that they take a more active role when it comes to training various stakeholders within the organization, training those who are responsible for defining roles, shortlisting, interviewing, making hiring decisions. I think you need to drive, as an organization, you need to drive continuous awareness, not only at leadership level, obviously it has to come from there, but at every level. And one of the feedback that I received on the back of the article is really should have addressed more the how men can become better allies to women. I think a lot of men are clueless about how to engage, how to really add value into this conversation, and quite a number of organizations outside of the aviation or aerospace industry really do a much better job tapping into the white male networks and getting their input and therefore achieve real change rather than just talking about it.
And I think a lot of that happens when gender diversity is driven from the highest levels. I remember before I retired that my senior executive took an active role, and I mean very active role, in making sure that when there was a management position that needed to be filled, that the slate of candidates for that position included a very diverse group of individuals, not only gender, race, or other minorities, but also diversity of thinking in the whole spectrum. And with that executive's focus on that, it just drove that notion throughout the organization. And I thought that was very, very powerful.
Yeah, and that's the only way it can work, really. So I think if it's not linked to the financial performance of an individual or an organization, then people will not take it seriously. Basically, bonuses, remuneration, reward should really be linked to how you perform on the diversity and gender balance side of things. If it's not a broader corporate business issue, just an HR diversity inclusion issue, it will never be taken seriously by the entire organization. No matter what level we are talking about, senior, mid managers, even lower ranks, you need to make people accountable. You need to really make sure that it's in the forefront of their mind every day.
Yes, I agree completely. And what about the role of role models? How about the importance of female role models and mentors?
It really depends on which organization we're talking about. Some airlines, for example, in the industry, I always point out how great a job Air New Zealand does with their various employee networks, whatever your gender, nationality, sexual orientation, whatever it is, you will have a group to discuss issues with your peers. I think when it comes to females, role models, there are some major challenges for people, especially for women, especially the next generation, because they are lacking role models at the highest corporate levels, basically at C-level, whether it's CFO, CEO, CTO, they don't really have someone to look up to and really just say, yes, this is an individual who can really, who I can reach out to, and she will probably be able to guide me as to how to best manage my career. I think that's what's missing, and a lot of good initiatives are happening and are taking place. Again, you need to look at it from a case-by-case sort of basis. One of the individuals I interviewed for the article, Christine O'Mears-Widner, the ex-Flybe CEO here in the UK, she established a campaign called Fly She, which aims to address the imbalance in the industry and inspire the next generations of aviators, basically. And it's about girls can't really be what they don't see. They need to be made aware of roles like everything controlling, other operational roles that are available in the industry, because I think schools, universities are not doing a good enough job when it comes to informing 17, 16, 18-year-olds who are having to make a decision as to what to do with their lives. Career counselors are not best equipped to provide that information.
This kind of topic has come up recently on the show in the context of aviation museums. And we've run across the comment frequently, or the notion frequently, that visitors to the museum, particularly younger people, but visitors need to see people a history, in the case of museums, oftentimes, who are like them. If you see someone like you that has done something significant or has done what you wish you could do, then it really boosts your motivation, and it creates a sense that you can accomplish that too, because someone just like you has done that. And I imagine, as you mentioned, it's the same for women in leadership roles. And so I think it behooves a company to try to make that very visible, that it is a path for women, in this case, to develop their career along these lines and to be successful. Are there some things that women can do to help their career in this often male-dominated industry?
Yes, definitely. I think it all comes down to being really proactive, being really someone who takes charge of their own career. So I think they can do much better when it comes to communicating their value to the organization, basically, and actively advocating for themselves. So I think it's quite important to point out these learnings are obviously not coming from me. These are points that I've been made aware through the conversations that I've had from with individuals who have really made it, who have risen to top of their organizations, whether they are CEOs or chief legal counsels. The way they did it is that they surrounded themselves with a very strong group of in both internal and external network. They joined mentoring organizations, schemes. Probably the one that I would mention is IAWA, which is the International Aviation Women's Association. They've been operating for more than 30 years now, and they run networking events around the globe from Singapore to New York on a very regular basis. They organize annual conferences. Another one is Women in Aviation, which is a U.S. organization, quite country-specific. They're going to be meeting early March. I think it's, in fact, next week in Orlando, where they're going to be having their annual meeting. It's a great place for female mentees and mentors to come together and really identify their needs and exchange experiences.
Arpad, one thing that I've seen in the past is different strategies, I'll call them, employed by women in this industry. I've seen some women who have been very successful by, I'll just simply say, being like the boys, you know, being like the men, acting like the men,
yep,
and fitting in that way. And then I've seen other women who've been successful as well, who are, they stay true to themselves, to what they are. They don't try to, or they haven't tried to in their career, act like the men. Has that come up in any of your conversations with women for this article?
Certainly, especially when it comes to Middle Eastern carriers, especially when you find yourself in a situation that you are the only female in a boardroom, you have to make sure that your voice is heard. Yes, you do have to act quite in a men-like manner. Otherwise, you're not going to be taken seriously. Otherwise, your voice is not going to be as I said, heard. And it's quite unfortunate that, especially in the airline business, I mean, it's a very macho-like business where most people who are currently in the higher echelons have come through the ranks, whether they were pilots or operational personnel. It's the ultimate voice swap. All you need to do is to have a look at the annual IATA picture that comes up from their annual general meeting. And you can see that when it comes to CEO level participants, it's almost exclusively male. And really to make that leap into that sort of segment, you essentially have to act like a man. And sometimes you don't really have a choice.
I imagine it could be kind of a dilemma for a woman as to how to be successful. But yeah, I can understand how it would be an issue that would have to be taken in the context of the company or the culture that that person is in. Let's talk a little bit about the pilot shortage. We talk about the pilot shortage a lot, and of course, the projections are for just huge numbers of pilots to be needed in the next 20 years, and not just pilots, but mechanics and other aviation professions. Is there a potential pool of women out there that could be a factor in addressing the pilot shortage?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, that's one way of addressing it. I think it's you just need to capture their attention at the right age. And I think the right age is definitely school level. You really need to make sure that they are aware of the myriad of options that are available to them. I think we have to bear in mind that aviation, I mean, I don't know how many people would say to you in a high school or secondary school, depending on which side of the pond you are, we're planning to go into aviation, really. I mean, the industry is competing with some really sexy industries like technology and other fields, which are just very well remunerated, quite easy to get into, and with the right sort of background, obviously. And they're doing, those organizations in those industries are doing a much better job at attracting a wide group of people, not only gender, but all other forms of diversity. I think the industry needs to bear in mind that it might not be the most attractive one at the moment. So I think that's how you really need to, airlines, airports, and many other stakeholders need to position themselves in a way that they just don't lose relevance. I think the competition is not between industry participants, but with whole other industries like the Amazons of the world, the Googles, the Ubers, you name it. I think there are plenty of attractive options out there for today's graduates. And if you don't come in at the right age, at the right level as an industry participant, you will lose them and you will not be able to engage them.
Arvind, one of the things that I noticed often in my career was women who had the skills, had the knowledge, had all the qualities necessary to be very, very successful in their career, but sometimes lacked the self-confidence. They had everything else, everything that you would hope for was there, except that sometimes they needed to be coached to understand that they were actually better than they thought they were, and needed a little bit more self-confidence. Do you think that's a big issue sort of more broadly?
Definitely. I think when it comes to coaching, mentoring, both inside and outside of the organization, I think it plays a crucial role. I think that's when pairing up with others, that's when organizations like the Royal Aeronautical Society, they've set up a mentoring scheme quite recently. It's called ALTA Mentoring, ALTA, which allows females to basically exchange their experiences, discuss things like work-life balance, and really allow them to build an internal and external network. I think you need to peer up. That's when male aligned with men in the workplace comes into play, because you really need them. Simply because they are the vast majority within any aviation organization, and you need to get them involved. You need to really get their view as well, and use them as a tool, as a resource to coach and mentor. I think they should play a more important role when it comes to coaching.
Yes, certainly. Well, Arpad, this is a very interesting topic, a very important one, I think. But while we have you, maybe you can tell us a little bit about air and space law at Leiden University. You mentioned that that's only available at two institutions. Tell us a little bit about, what's the scope of air and space law at a university level like this?
Air and space law mainly concerns it has many facets to it, but probably the most important ones are liability, like what happens when it comes to major air catastrophes, safety aspects, obviously aircraft financing, leasing laws. You get a really good introduction to those. When it comes to policy, especially here in Europe, of course, it's the European Commission that sets the standards and the rules in terms of competition, in terms of consumer protection, things like EU regulation 261, 204. That's the regulation that sets the standards in terms of compensation for denied boarding, cancellation, and the like. So it's a fascinating field, very niche, of course. This is why there are only two highly regarded institutions in the world. One obviously based here in Europe, the other one based in Montreal, which some would argue is the aviation capital of certainly North America.
Interesting.
Like aviation law, for example, or policy, I mean, that's an area where a lot of people are not even aware of it, that it exists. And I think the reason for that is because the field itself is not doing a good enough job of advertising itself to people to explore it and see if it's for them. I think it's a very niche part of the law, of course, but it's very important, and it regulates how we fly, where we fly, with under what conditions we fly. If you think about it, it might be niche, but it's an integral part of the aviation ecosystem.
Yes, for sure. Well, another important piece of this ecosystem, I think, is the search firms. Is there a strong role for search firms to play when it comes to diversity in the workforce?
I think there is a critical role for search firms because they play such an important role when it comes to identifying individuals, assessing them. As a search firm, your added value is basically to challenge organizations to really go the extra mile in terms of looking at other related industries, looking into the travel, hospitality, leisure side of things. Obviously, trying to look for people who might not have the technical or operational background, but could add value to your business. I think there's quite a lot of education that needs to go in it because, as I mentioned earlier, firms operating in the aviation space tend to be really conservative and traditional. And your ability to challenge organizations to be to be less traditional and then consider individuals who are not from the same sort of cut, I think that's where your added value comes. And take risks when hiring. I mean, hiring is a very risky business, but it's certainly worth it in most cases.
Oh, very good. And we'll have a link to Arpad's article in the show notes for this episode. I think that it's a really well done piece. And obviously, Arpad, you did a lot of good research, had a lot of good conversations with folks that have something to say about this issue of diversity and inclusion. But to finish off, let me ask you overall regarding the future of women in aviation. Are you optimistic? Are you concerned about the future or something else?
I think there is cause for optimism, of course, because when it comes to organizations like IATA and ICAO, there's a lot that is being done. For example, the 25 by 2025 campaign, which is a pledge between IATA and the airlines to ensure that they're all prioritizing diversity. It's evidence that change is definitely on its way. At the state level or at an international level, ICAO with its air transport gender equality initiative is doing a great job providing statistics, forecasting that will be a very practical tool to assist countries, states in identifying gaps in personnel planning and training and also gender inequality. So I think both at an organizational level and at an industry trade level, an awful lot of good is happening. And as I mentioned, organizations like IAWA, the International Aviation Women's Association, is doing an exceptional job in really keeping this issue in the forefront of airline boardrooms' minds.
Well, that's just fantastic. Arpad, we want to thank you for spending a few moments with us and with our audience. It's been a very interesting conversation. Appreciate you taking the time. And I'll let you tell our audience where they can find Cellence Plus on the web or any other resources online that folks might be interested in.
Yeah, I think the easiest way to find me would be on LinkedIn if you put in Arpad, S-Z-A-K-A-L. You'll find me easily. Our website is cellence.com, which is C-E-L-L-E-N-C-E.com. And I'm also on other forms of social media, but I think LinkedIn is probably the best way of connecting and having a discussion if you're open to it.
Very good. Arpad, thanks again for joining us.
Thank you, Max, again, for the opportunity to spend time with you.
Well, that was really good, Max. A lot of good points there and kind of some eye-opening things. Well, what was your takeaway?
Well, while some of the tips, the pointers that Arpad mentioned are actually applicable to men or women, you know, anybody seeking to develop and expand their career, a lot of it is really specific to the situation that women find themselves in these days, which is that we're in a heavily male-dominated industry. And there are roles that a lot of people in organizations need to play in order to improve the situation. There's some things that women can do. There's some things that men within the organization can do to support women. There are things that the company, the organization itself needs to do and what leadership needs to do. And something that I hadn't really considered before speaking with Arpad is that companies that that identify talent for companies, recruitment firms, also have a role to play in all this. One thing that Arpad did mention after we spoke is that he's actually working on a second article that is going to focus on the things that men specifically can do to support women in aviation. Now, in the course of our conversation, he mentioned a number of different sites and resources, and we'll have those in the show notes for this episode at airplanegeeks.com/593. So be sure to check those out. Of course, some of them I think that, you know, we're already familiar with. Women in Aviation International, for sure. That's at WAI.org. But he also mentioned this International Aviation Women's Association, IAWA, which I had not been familiar with. And maybe we can in the future look to have a guest from that organization. And then we'll also have a link to the ALTA mentoring platform from the Royal Aeronautical Society that Arpad mentioned. And also, I'll give a shout out to his IT department who tried valiantly to let us in through the firewall, but ultimately we just had to have that phone call recording. So thanks again for that.
What's up with the geeks? Let's see. What is up with the geeks? David, you have an item, I think.
Yeah, it's not necessarily about me, but I lost a hero today, sort of. If anybody has spent time watching Inside the Actors Studio, unfortunately, the day we record this, March 2nd, we lost James Lipton, who was the consummate interviewer. And inside, he was an actor, a director, and the show was very famous because at the end of it, there were 10 questions. The last two were, what was your favorite curse word? And what do you want God to say to you when you reach the pearly gates?
This is Inside the Actor's Studio.
Yes, this is Inside the Actor's Studio. What I didn't know was James Lipton was also a pilot. And we'll have a link to the show notes, but AOPA did an interview with him, turned the tides on him being the interviewee and not the interviewer. It's a very interesting short 10-minute interview. Well done, of course, because it was AOPA, but it was interesting hearing his perspective on flying and what makes a good flight, you know. And they asked him, what did he want to hear when he got to the pearly gates? And, I'll leave that because you should read the interview. But yeah, it's kind of interesting when you find out somebody was a pilot that you didn't know, but you respected for other things. It's sort of like, oh, and he was a pilot too. Cool.
Yeah.
You didn't know. So it's always interesting that there's a lot more pilots out there, GA pilots, that maybe you don't know that are pilots. So interesting. You know, I think I want to go back and watch the Tom Cruise interview to see if he even mentions flying to Tom, given that. So that was my week, other than I got some feedback from people in the local area who listened to the show and thought that the Tuskegee interview was good. So I was happy with that. We're prepping for an upcoming event at the Helicopter Museum called Open Cockpit Day, something they've never done before and that Vanderhoof is pushing on. So we're going to have some of the helicopters that most people can't climb in normally open to the public, much like every other aviation museum in the country. So with that, I'll turn it over to Max West. Do you have anything besides flying?
Well, I have a rather interesting connection here to Max East. I spent most of the day Saturday at Moffett Field, where there was the final awarding of some of the prizes related to the GoFly Innovation Prize. And so I learned a lot about that. Interviewed the founder of GoFly, Gwen Leiter. Gwen's got an interesting background. She graduated from Harvard Law School and she founded GoFly a few years ago and basically went and got sponsors, including Boeing, Pratt & Whitney, and others, to put up a total of about $2 million in prizes for teams to develop prototypes of a near vertical takeoff and landing vehicle. So it didn't have to be perfectly straight up, but something that was somewhat close to that. And there were some pretty tight requirements for it. The entire vehicle had to fit within 102 inches, so basically an 8.5-foot circle, if you will, had to be able to cruise at 30 knots, had to be able to carry a 200-pound person for at least 20 minutes without refueling or recharging. So for 1 or 2 days, they had the vehicles that had made it to the final round out at Half Moon Bay on Thursday and Friday doing some of their final flyoffs. And then Saturday was really a day of kind of show and tell and a few demonstrations and then awarding of prizes. Interestingly, one vehicle looked like it was going to qualify for the main prize of $1 million. And I interviewed Mariah Kane, who's from the Dragon Air team from Florida, who had created that vehicle. And it turned out they had a little glitch. One of their ESCs, the electronic speed controls that controlled one of the 8 motors, failed during that flight, which caused the vehicle to bump down to the ground and was unable to complete its 20 minutes of flying. She's a very dynamic young lady, previously has been a hydro flying athlete. So you've certainly seen these YouTube videos of people who are on flying devices connected to powerful water hoses. She does that. And she's also put together a team to build this vehicle. And apparently hers was the only one that might have qualified, but except for this failure. It was kind of interesting. She said that she weighs, I think, 115 pounds. So she had to wear 85 pounds of weighted, you know, vest and so on to bring her up to 200 pounds for this competition. And she said that in test flights, they'd had ESCs failed before, but never when she was fully weighted. So in this particular case, she was wearing her 85 pound vest. And that when the failure occurred, there just wasn't enough power or enough, you know, response time to keep the vehicle from touching down to the ground. So it was a fascinating day. The announcement was that they would not award the $1 million prize, but that they would continue it. So the competition is going to remain open. They've literally had hundreds of teams from around the world compete for it. Pratt & Whitney did award their Disruptor Prize for $100,000 for an innovative type vehicle. That was awarded to a Team Tetra, which was from Japan. And that vehicle kind of looked like a cross between a motorcycle and, you know, some type of small hovercraft with four large fans on it. The other teams were from various other places. There was one, as I mentioned, Dragon Air was from Florida. There was a team from MIT. And so anyway, just a number of interesting designs. It was fun to see all of those at Moffett Field.
Very cool. Very, very cool. So you said you interviewed some of these folks. Are you going to have those on your podcast?
Yes, I think we'll have those in a week or so.
Aviation News Talk podcast. Cool. All right. We have a very short 3-minute recording from our main man, Micah. After our last episode, he couldn't help himself. So let's listen to Micah.
Bemidji, Minnesota? It was so nice to hear Sam Abulismid talk about his time in Bemidji, Minnesota. And to know that he's a regular listener of ours, wow! I listen to Sam every week with Leo Laporte on Twit, and boy, does he know cars. I guess he knows airplanes, too. But yeah, I've been to Bemidji, Minnesota. I interviewed for a job there in the late 1980s. I remember flying from Pueblo, Colorado, my home at the time, to Denver, to Minneapolis, St. Paul, to Bemidji. It was a Twin Otter Dash 6 to Denver, a 727 to Minneapolis, St. Paul, and a Beach Baron to Bemidji sometime in the late spring of 1987, all booked on Continental Airlines and their regional carriers. I can't remember the name of the regional that took me to and from Bemidji, but it was a great Rocky Mountain Air that always took me between Pueblo and Denver, always on a Dash 6 or a Dash 7. The four-engine Stoll aircraft, they flew all over the Colorado Rockies into and out of ski areas with short runways. The people in Bemidji were really nice, but to me it felt like I was in Lake Wobegon, the fictional Minnesota town from Garrison Keillor's short stories. They kept referring to the cities, some distant and far-off land. It took me quite some time to realize they were talking about Minneapolis-St. Paul, which in the winter, well, it was truly a distant and far-off land from Bemidji, about 225 miles southeast. They kept telling me that we were right on the Continental Divide. Huh? Continental Divide? I lived on the eastern side of the Rocky Mountains at the time. The Continental Divide was west of me. How could I be on the Continental Divide so far east in Minnesota? Well, I finally figured it out. It was the north-south Continental Divide. This was a spot that separated the water that flows into the Gulf of Mexico from the water that flows into Hudson Bay. The ice had only just come out completely from Lake Bemidji when I was there, and the place I was going to work was right on the lake. They told me how I was going to enjoy the ice fishing in the winter, the bass, muskellunge, and pike fishing during the rest of the year, and how I would love the fall hunting season. Me? Hunt and fish? Not this man who grew up in the New York metropolitan area. When I found out that the average high temperature in January was 16 degrees Fahrenheit, that's minus 8 degrees Celsius, well, let me just say that I'm glad I didn't get that job and found a warm place to live here in Portland, Maine. Now, that's not to say that Bemidji is a bad place or a place I wouldn't want to visit again. Well, maybe not in January, but it might be a nice place to explore sometime. So for the airplane geeks here in Portland, Maine, this is your Minnesota man. This is your Maine man, Micah.
Trescott, I have to admit, though, last week, the fact that you got it right out of just pronouncing it and sounding it out, God bless you.
You're right, because I had not heard of Bemidji before, you know, and I just had to look it up because he was talking about that, you know, average 16 degree January. So Portland, Maine is actually warmer. So he is enjoying a warm 31 degrees on average in January in Portland, Maine. So good move.
Having closed a retail store in Minnesota the third week in January and then catching pneumonia because I was closing a retail store at Mall of America in Minnesota. It's cold. Sorry, not my cup of tea, folks, even though I live in a cold zone, sort of.
You guys, I think, have better memories than I do. If you asked me what did I do in 1987, I don't have a clue. If you ask, you know, bring up some random trip from 10 or 15 or 20 or 30 years ago and ask me what airplane I was flying on or what airline, I have no idea.
No, and I wasn't surprised when Micah said, and I don't remember the airline. Are you kidding me? Of course you don't. I won't remember what airline I flew on 6 months ago, much less 30 years ago.
Wow. All right, a little bit of listener mail. We heard from Patrick. He sent along some interesting things. One is a cartoon from Mike Shelton, I think is the artist here. It's from Comics Kingdom. We'll have a link to this in the show notes, but it's... You know, it's a one-panel cartoon that sort of combines the issues of having no space on commercial flights these days, what with coach all smashed together, and the issue of do you recline your seat or not. So we have a little graphic here of AAA, any American airline, as it's labeled, and the interior is essentially a big giant vise that has the passengers all squished together, and then the pilot's up front saying, "Remember your airplane etiquette. Ask the person behind you before reclining your seat." Of course, nobody in this little cartoon could even. I don't think they could even breathe. They're so jammed together.
Well, the best part of it, too, is you look behind the pilots, and there's a huge amount of space for them where they could practically make those seats recline flat if they wanted to. Quite different from what the passengers have in this cartoon.
So Patrick also sent an article. This is from electric.co. And David, this is probably something we should talk about this week on the UAV Digest, but he says on a more serious note.
I think it's a really hot story that, you know, we do need to cover.
Yes. Here's an example of electric flight helping with the recent health scare. And the article title is eVTOL to be used as ambulances in the coronavirus crisis. Now, this is about the eHang, which is a Chinese eVTOL. It's what's this got, David? Eight pairs of rotors. It's like, you know, the octocopter with a pod in the center for a person. And this is something that's actually been flying
I think we've been talking close to 2 years, but I think it's been flying for close to a year.
So, and they call this an autonomous aerial vehicle, electric, of course. And the local, a local government in Guangxi province are using this EHang 216 to transport medical supplies to a local hospital. It's about 2.5 miles away. And then the autonomous EHang returned back to its home base. It's great to see this kind of thing. You know, we talk about eVTOLs on the UAV Digest podcast and how medical supply delivery seems to be one of the, you know, one of the big applications.
Yeah, and one of the things that the dovetail what we say is it's an optimal for for drone delivery, it's an optimal application because when you're delivering supplies or tests or something, you've got small packages that need to be delivered quickly, which seems drones and drone delivery seems to be a niche. Medical delivery seems to be a niche. And with this, we're talking about optimizing the amount of time or not optimizing. What am I trying to say?
It's been that kind of night for all of us here tonight. I don't know what's up with it.
You are trying to minimize the amount of time humans are in contact with the medical supplies or, more importantly, the tests. So you've got that advantage also to this drone delivery. So it's a positive UAV story, but I think Max will dive more into it on this week's UAV Digest.
Yes. And Patrick had more for us, but he had a lot of stuff in this email. This was good. He mentions that in the last episode, 592, he said you discussed FOD in fuel tanks. He says it reminded me of something I experienced a couple of years ago. So he says, while pre-flighting an old 1958 182 for a day of flying skydivers, I was, quote, sticking the tanks, which of course means checking fuel levels. And when the tube I use, he said, to do that, hit something. So he used a flashlight to peer down into the tank, and he laughed. He said, then called the boss over and asked him to have a look. We both laughed. Floating there in the tank was a 2x4. He says, what the heck? So he says, the boss owned the plane for decades, and I had hundreds of hours flying it, but neither of us had ever seen the 2x4 before. It was too big to fit through the fuel filler opening, so it had to have been in there since the fuel bladder was installed many, many years ago. Fortunately, wood floats in avgas, so it never got in the way of the fuel line or the fuel flow. By the way, he says, I checked with an A&P and learned that it is a common practice to use a 2x4 to push the rubber bladder into place when installing it, but it is not common practice to leave the 2x4 in there. So he says, we thought about just leaving it in there because of what it would cost to get it removed, but safety won out and it was removed. So Patrick says, take that, Boeing. You're not the only one with FOD in your tanks.
That is an amazing story. I had something interesting happen. Oh, gosh, it's been over 10 years ago. We had a brand new Cessna 172 that had come in from the factory, and I was in it one day, and suddenly we heard something drop, and we were on the ground. We hadn't started the engine yet, and we went looking down there by the rudder pedals, and there was the largest screwdriver I think I have ever seen, which had fallen down behind the pedals. I mean, this thing had to be, I don't know, easily a foot and a half long. It was a big, you know, it's not your normal little screwdriver. And apparently it got left there, you know, at the factory. But fortunately, it wasn't any place where, you know, it caused a problem. Just in the rudder pedals. It's like, great. Wouldn't that be nice if that thing had jammed up the pedals?
Yeah, that's like when you drop your phone and it suddenly decides to want to wedge under your brake pedal or something like
right,
that.
Yeah.
It just scares the hell out of you.
Yep.
That does happen.
So if any of you listening have any other fun FOD stories from your experience, be sure to send them in. I don't think anybody will be able to top Patrick's 2x4 story, but you never know. Somebody might have some interesting or close calls.
What other objects have you left in your airplane in places where it doesn't belong?
That's right. All right. We're going to wrap it up. Thanks for listening to the Airplane Geeks podcast. We want to thank our guest, Arpad Sekal from CellencePlus.com. That's CELLENCE. And we'll have a link to the article that he researched and wrote, which is really a good article. Very good. Highly recommend it. And we're going to look forward to his subsequent article on what men can do to support women in aviation. You can find us at airplanegeeks.com, and the link that'll take you right to the show notes for this episode is airplanegeeks.com/593. As always, reach us via email at thegeeks@airplanegeeks.com. So, David Vanderhoof, where do we find you online or elsewhere?
You can find me elsewhere at the American Helicopter Museum. Definitely, if you're in the area of Philadelphia, let me know and we'll bring you to the museum. Or you can find me on Twitter, Facebook, LinkedIn. If you can spell Vanderhoof, there we go. We're going back to it. And last but not least, you can find me on our there's more. You can find me on our Slack listener team by sending an email to thegeeks@airplanegeeks.com. We'll send you an invite and you can join the conversation. And last but not least, you can find me on Fridays talking about eVTOL and medical delivery and drones and being very punny on the UAVDigest.com.
Yeah, David has David comes up with puns just on the turn of the dime or the drop of the hat.
On the fly. We're an aviation show. Come on.
Yeah, on the fly. Yeah. All right. Max Trescott.
Well, I can't compete with any of that, but I did want to let everybody know that this week on Aviation News Talk, I took my private check ride again 40 years later. It's a mock oral private check ride given to me by pilot examiner Jason Blair. So it's great for anyone who's a student pilot and kind of wonders what the check ride would be like. And it's also a great review for anyone who is a certificated pilot and has to do their flight review, also previously known as a BFR, every 2 years, because we covered a lot of the same things that you would be asked during a flight review. And you can find that at aviationnewstalk.com. And if you want to shoot me an email, go to that site and just click on contact at the top of the page.
And I'm looking forward to hearing those interviews about the contest.
Yeah, we'll do that.
Why does Jason Blair sound familiar?
Well, I'm sure we've had him on the show here in the past. He's the past executive director of NAFI, the National Association of Flight Instructors.
Oh, right. See, I told you I can't remember anything.
That's what we're here for, your virtual memory.
Yeah, I need it. All right, so you can find me on Twitter at Max Flight. If you can spell Max Flight, that's not too hard, though. Look for me on LinkedIn at the UAVDigest.com with David. Also with Mary Kirby at PaxXPodcast.com. In fact, we're recording another episode tomorrow. So please join us again next week as we talk aviation on the Airplane Geeks podcast. Bye, everybody.
Keep the blue side up.
And thanks for listening.